Hi, everyone. Welcome in to the latest installment of West Virginia Talk with James and Jerry. I'm James.
And I'm Jerry.
And today's episode will be all things Harpers Ferry. Now, there's a lot to cover, so this is going to be part one of a two-part episode. And the second part, we're going to be talking to a Harpers Ferry park ranger, Leah Tabor.
Yeah, and she is very knowledgeable of the national park since it's her job.
Right, yeah. What a dream job, man. That'd be so cool.
Growing up, I always wanted to be outside, and I failed miserably at that.
Plus, the uniform looks awesome.
Yeah.
Love it. So, Harpers Ferry, a town in Jefferson County. It is in West Virginia's Eastern Panhandle at the confluence of the Potomac and the Shenandoah. And if you've ever sang Country Roads, it's in there, Shenandoah River.
Yeah.
It's also nestled in the shadows of Maryland and Virginia in the mountains there, surrounded by West Virginia, Virginia, Maryland. Well, Harpers Ferry, the lowest elevation in the state.
Right. So the West Virginia part, though, is the best part of that entire park. I will say that.
Of course. Harpers Ferry is a place with so much history. It's itself a museum. The whole lower town. Most of these buildings are 1800s, some are 1700s. It's a step back in time.
Well, and if you're looking for thrill rides and amusement parks, probably not the place for you.
Nope.
But if you love seeing how things developed in this country and the history of it, and honestly, it covers so much. I mean, it's not just one thing.
Yeah.
It's all sorts of history.
It's the best of both worlds. You're indoors as much as you want or outdoors as much. I like Disney World.
Right.
Disney World, of course, you're walking outside, but most of the things that you're doing is in a building. Mm-hmm. And Harpers Ferry is no different except for what you're encountering
right
in the day. So Harpers Ferry, it's home to 100 structures that are on the National Register of Historic Places. It is definitely the definition of picturesque for different reasons.
Yeah, and it's amazing how many photographers have gone there and pictures that they've taken that have made national media.
Right.
You know, they've been in highly recognized magazines, newspapers, and books.
Yeah, if you love the railroad, boom, that's the place for you. If you love the water, same thing. Rocks, if you like rock climbing or just looking at them, if you love architecture, it's all there for you, all of it. If you love history, this is definitely the place for you. So let's talk a little bit about the history, Jerry. The Tuscarora Indians lived here for roughly 8,000 years until, of course, the whites came. Dun, dun, dun. Here come the whites.
You know, I know we say this 1,000 times, but I do feel so bad. Like, I don't think I'd want anything changed because
I know. I'm saying I'm not marginalizing it, but it seems like every time we talk about the history of any place in the state,
it starts there. Yes.
Yeah. The Native Indians were there. Yes. Native Americans were there first, and then here we came. So, Robert Harper, the namesake of the town, he acquired this land in 1751 from a man who had squatters' rights.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So, he wanted the land because he saw potential for money in building a ferry, you know, from Maryland to West Virginia. Well, it was all Virginia then, mm-hmm. but if you look at it now, Maryland to West Virginia to Virginia, and so forth. So,
and he's the one that introduced slavery or slaves to the area, too. He did.
Hate that.
I know.
Hate it.
He was the first to bring them into the area.
Hate it. So, before it was known as Harper's Ferry, it was called Shenandoah Falls at Mr. Harper's Ferry. Not real catchy. So they shortened it up a little bit. Years later, George Washington began construction. Well, he pitched the idea of construction on the Harper's Ferry Armory in 1785. And much like Washington, the town. Today, once they propose something, it takes a long time to get the ball rolling. So he proposed it in 1785. And it was built in 1802. And the people that he pitched this idea to, they're like, no, that's crazy. Why would you want to put it there? So he had several good reasons why. How about this? A great place for water power.
Absolutely.
How about this? Iron ore up and down the banks of the river. Great place for hardwood, especially maple. And what do you use maple for? How about gun stocks?
How about
that?
Syrup?
Well, that maple's great for syrup.
Oh.
Better than oak syrup, anyway. Proximity to Georgetown's harbor, which was 68 miles up the river. So 125 acres were bought 11 years later. The armory was built, and production began in 1802. At its peak, Jerry.
Yeah.
This armory was 6 football fields long.
That's impressive.
That's huge. For 1802? That's crazy. That's,
and, you know, they... What, how long did that last? 60 years?
60 years, yeah.
They made, I think it was like 6,000.
It was over 500,000 guns.
600,000. So yes. 600,000 guns.
Yeah.
And back then, you got to think, that's quite a feat.
Well, the technology back then was pretty, you know, I don't
pretty basic.
I don't want to call it prehistoric, but man, it was in its infantile stages right. for, you know, mass production. You know, when they started building guns, they didn't even have standardized parts yet. So you had to build them specific to each gun.
Everything was handcrafted.
You couldn't interchange anything. So if you had something break in your gun, well, good luck trying to find a part for that thing.
Right.
But eventually, standardized parts for guns were developed there by John Hall. This armory is also where Lewis and Clark picked up most of the rifles and powder in preparation for the Corps of Discovery expedition. Their expedition to the West.
And that's something a lot of people don't realize. That's probably one of the least known facts about this area.
I love the Lewis and Clark expedition. It's one of my favorite stories from history mm-hmm. of this country. Just awesome. Love that. This place is also the site of the John Brown Raid.
Yes.
Who was John Brown? John Brown, and you could call him eccentric. He was an abolitionist,
yeah,
but he didn't use words. He used actions. And so John Brown saw an opportunity to try to end slavery his own way, which was he was watching this armory in 1859, knew that it was not guarded the way it should have been.
Right.
Because the armory, no. And the armory held 100,000 guns at that time. So he and some of his sons, some freed blacks, they got a plan together. They were going to use pikes and not guns because it was all going to be quiet.
Right.
They were going to do it at night. They were going to create a diversion with the guards that were there. So they, they created a diversion on the railroad. So the train stopped. The guards went to go check out what was going on. They made their move. And things probably would have went their way completely if he would have known that they stored guns up the town also, and the soldiers came. And who were the soldiers led by?
Was it Lee?
Robert E. Lee, yeah. Yes. And, you know, they started, they had way more manpower. They had way more guns. I mean, yeah, John Brown had access to 100,000 guns, but how many men did he have?
Right.
Not many. No. So they wound up getting flushed out of the armory, and they holed up in the armory's fire engine house. Yes, they had fire engines then.
horse-drawn.
Yeah, and this thing's old. It's still at the park. It is very old. But the problem was the windows were too high, and they just – waited for them to ram the doors.
Yeah.
Which they did, and they were captured and executed, including John Brown. He was executed. There was only one of John Brown's party that got away. Only
really?
One of them, yes. A couple of them tried to swim in the river. They were found and shot and, wow. and that kind of thing. But John Brown went on trial in Charlestown, right up the road from Harper's Ferry. He was found guilty, and he was hanged for treason. But, the thing is, John Brown's raid kind of sparked the Civil War because now slavery became a topic of debate. Yeah, not just discussion, but debate.
It was a bigger issue, much bigger issue after that.
Oh, it was huge.
Well, I mean, I guess technically it was a bigger issue before that too, but it, like you said, it was brought to light in a greater way.
Yeah. So John Brown raid, the most famous thing that Harper's Ferry is associated with. Now, get this. That was in 1859, right?
Right.
Robert E. Lee was the head of those troops that squashed the raid. 3 years later, Confederate General Robert E. Lee comes and captures the town. In 1862, 12,400 Union troops surrendered to the Confederates. It was the largest surrender of troops to an invading army in Civil War history.
And this time, the same thing occurs with the knowledge of where all the guns are. And so the Union tries to get rid of it. They try to burn it before the Confederates could get a hold of it and start shipping the plans down to other southern areas.
Yes.
And they failed.
Yep.
They failed. The Confederates end up getting it. They sent the information down. Then when the Confederacy would leave, they would destroy that before they let it go back to the Union.
Yeah, so ultimately it was destroyed in 1862. Both sides tried destroying it, but the Confederates ultimately succeeded in destroying it. But it's a shame, you know. I would have liked to have seen some of the armory. And really, the fire engine house is the only thing left, you know. So, but the fire engine house is pretty cool, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, like I mentioned before, Harper's Ferry, Lower Town, it's home to 100 structures on the National Register of Historic Places. So, what are some of these places? Well, how about the Harper House? This is what got it started, you know. Harper was the founder of the town, basically, and now he was older. He started building his house in 1775, and 6 years after he started building it, he passed away. But the next owner finished it, and it's still there today. Harper House, 1775.
Do they have a dry goods store down there?
Oh, they got plenty. They got plenty of places like that. The dry goods store, yes.
Wow.
It is there. They have Frankel's clothing store. Now, you got to remember, let me back up a second. So the way that Lower Town is laid off, it's like walking through a town today, only everything is set in the 1800s, okay? So it's not an 1800s building with a modern business in it. It's a 1800s building with an 1800s business in it.
So it's basically, we're talking a Disney World for historians.
Yes. Well put. Well put. So there's all these buildings that you walk into, and you get an eyeful of the inside of this thing, but you can't go beyond the barrier. So you can walk in a couple feet, and then you have to stop behind the barrier. That includes Frankel's Clothing Store. So Frankel's Clothing Store would look like a clothing store from the 1800s. They have the top hats. They have the big boots that women wore. They have these old sewing machines, real small, with the foot pedal and the hand crank and all that stuff. And the blacksmith shop is there. I
love blacksmith shops.
Well, you can't go to an 1800s town without seeing the blacksmith shop, yeah. You know, making the horseshoes and all the trim for wagons and the wheels and all that stuff. So, yeah, they have an actual blacksmith in there pounding away on the anvil. You know, he's making something all the time. You know, blacksmiths still exist, just not in the capacity that they used to.
Can you buy things when you're in those shops?
Not those. Okay. But I'll get to the ones that you can.
Okay.
So they also have what is called a provost marshal office. Any idea what that is?
U.S. Marshal? Not really.
No. No.
Okay. No.
Now, when I went to college, the head of the college was a provost.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, so it's academia. No. A provost marshal was the head of the military police.
All righty.
Okay? So not actual police. It was military police. Mrs. Stipe's boarding house. A lot of troops that guarded the armory would stay at Mrs. Stipe's boarding house. You actually get to go in the boarding house and check out some of the artifacts that were left behind. And as Jerry mentioned, the dry goods store, you know, anything that you would need to feed the folks or nails or whatever, it's all in there.
I love, like, that's one of my favorite things when I watch a Western.
Yeah.
Or any of the older shows is when they go into the stores and you see those old wooden barrels and they're scooping out the wheat and they're, that just to me, just, I don't know, it brings like this different feeling to you, you know, like something.
It's nostalgic, even though you weren't there ever in those times. You know, a lot of canned goods and jarred goods, and they actually have a big glass case that were full of toys that were available to buy in the 1800s.
Wow.
Pretty neat stuff, man. The confectionery. What's a confectionery?
Are we talking candy?
They are talking candy. Mm. So what was neat is you're looking at the counter and they have all these confections under glass and you're like, what did they make in the 1800s as far as candy? And you get a look of all the things that they had. Now, the one thing that I expected to see was ribbon candy.
Right.
Nope. No ribbon candy.
That was afterwards, huh?
Yeah, right. So, and I'm trying to think of how it's pronounced, but non-pennials or perennials or whatever. You know what I'm talking about? It's like, it looks like chocolate, but it's different pastel colors, and they have the, like the sugar on top. Yeah, they're in there, and things like that.
What about peanut butter brittle? Was that around that time, you think?
Possibly? I'm sure.
It's possible.
Well, like you said earlier, when you're there, you're trying to take all this stuff in, and you're like, I can't remember all this stuff. I think I'm above average when it comes to memory, but even I can't remember all the things that were on that counter. And then they had things like you would expect, like whorehound and clove candy.
One, they should be ashamed for the first name. And two, you know, I like clove.
Not me, buddy.
I get that. I like that numbing sensation that cloves can give you.
Have you ever eaten ham in a holiday and you bit right into a clove?
I intentionally bit into the clove.
Oh, that's, I can't do it, man. Can't do it.
When you had a toothache and stuff back then, man, that was great for numbing the gum area.
Thank God I never had a toothache when I was young. All right, so they also have Burton Jewelry Store. They have the old watches and everything in there, pocket watches. The John Brown's Fort, which we mentioned earlier, it was the fire engine house for the arsenal built in 1848. The Restoration House. Now, this is kind of ambiguous of a name to lend to a place like this. So when they have the sign out front of the building, you're like, Restoration House, what is that? Go in there. It's worth it. It's so cool. What it is they got this house that no one was living in anymore, and they decided to do an archaeological dig in the house. They took the floor away, and they started digging below. So they found out that this house actually covers two old foundations to homes that aren't there anymore. And you see all the, it's kind of like what you would see if you went to the Monticello.
Right.
They're constantly doing an archaeological survey or dig at the Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home in Charlottesville. But this is a permanent exhibit, you know, where they dug below this foundation and found two separate foundations and an alley between them.
Wow.
Isn't that neat?
That is cool.
And what's cool is the way that the alley's laid out with the cobblestones, there's still like grass grown in between the rocks, even though it's in a building. I don't know how that works, but a lot of windows in the place and it's getting plenty of sun, I guess.
But so you're walking over on like little bridge or something?
Yeah. So it's a raised metal platform. You don't want to actually step into the old foundations, but you walk above them. And along the way, they have these plaques that tell you, if you look at this, it's this, and it was probably built at this time. They have the old hearth and stuff like that. It's really, really cool. Being a history buff, I love that building probably more than most. They also have what is called an industry museum. Now, the friend I took, he's big into guns. Mm-hmm. He's a gun collector. And the industry museum actually has all these machines that they use to make guns. You had one that made the stock. You had one that, straightened the metal out for barrels. You had one that, you know, rifled the inside of it and all these other things. And it encompasses so much space. And you know that these things have belts, right?
That's what I was going to say. These are all belt driven
these machines. And what they were these really wide leather straps. So and it said that sometimes when the belt would snap, things would break and it would kill the people making this stuff. I mean, it was really dangerous back then. They have the Civil War Museum, and that of course is self-explanatory. A lot of Civil War history in Harper's Ferry. Go in there and check out all the memorabilia that's lends itself to the Civil War. They have the Allies for Freedom building. And what the Allies for Freedom was, It was the five freed black men that helped John Brown raid Harper's Ferry in 1859. So it details their life, their lives and backgrounds. The Black Voices building. Now, when I was there, it was closed.
Right.
And when we talk to Leah Tabor here in a little while, maybe she'll shed some light on that building as well. The John Brown Wax Museum. I'm telling you, this is a favorite for a lot of people because this is a nostalgic, older type exhibit. These wax figures were put in there, I don't know, maybe the 60s. And you can see that they're old, but it's still a neat step-by-step beginning of John Brown's raid to the finish, which was his hanging.
Little fact, I've never been in a wax museum.
It's neat. It's neat. And the neatest thing about it, and when I was there Wednesday, I forgot to even look to see what was happening. But the first person killed in the John Brown raid was a free black man that worked for the railroad. So it was very, you know, bad look for the John Brown raid. But anyway, there's a depiction of him in wax figures of at the train station. He's laying down on his back, and there's people looking down to see if he's okay. And the wax figure of him is breathing.
Ooh.
Yeah, a lot of people don't like it, you know, because his eyes are wide open after getting shot and he's breathing. Little kids don't like it, I'm telling you.
I was going to say, that's going to creep out some people.
Yeah, grown people, yes, yeah. It's going to freak them out a little bit. The Lockwood House, just, you know, it was an older house built in 1848 that two different Union generals used as their headquarters during the Civil War. When you come into the lower town, there is a cathedral up on the hill. It's kind of a dominating building in the landscape of Harper's Ferry. It's the St. Peter's Roman Catholic Church. And I tell you, you look at this church, you know it's old by the architecture of it, but you really don't know how old it is because it looks so good, you know. Built in 1833, wow. So not too long from now, it's going to be 200 years old. And then a little farther up the trail, when you're headed towards Jefferson Rock, there to the right, you have the St. John's Episcopal Church ruins. And it's neat. There's so many different places in Harper's Ferry where it's just ruins, but they're doing their best to preserve the ruins.
Right. It's America's version of Greece, Athens.
Yeah, yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
You know, they preserved all those wonderful structures,
sure,
that they had, and although maybe not as magnificent as those,
sure,
in their own right, we want to see them stay around for a very long time.
I think it's cool, man. I mean, you're just feet away from a building that was built in 1852, and it's crumbled down. And, you know, one of my hobbies, I'm a relic hunter.
Right.
And, you know, when you get to a place like that, you're like, oh, man. It's a national park. If they even see a metal detector in my car, I'm going to go to jail. So if you're a metal detector enthusiast, do not bring it to Harper's Ferry with you. Trust me on that.
And he is such a relic hunter that I've even contemplated that if they did another movie of The Librarian, that I was going to write and see if they'd cast him and see, because he would qualify.
Yes, definitely. Been doing it 30 plus years. Speaking of ruins, there is they called it the small arsenal because the main arsenal ran along the Potomac, and the small arsenal was at the corner of the Potomac and the Shenandoah Rivers. So the ruins are still there.
Right.
And it has on the plaques, it has what it looked like when it was built and, you know, what you're looking at now.
I mean, basically now, isn't it pretty much just kind of squared off or rectangled off where it laid and just...
Oh, you can put your hand right on it. Yeah, it's really neat, man. Another old building there, the bookstore. And the bookstore is going to be the first place that you can walk into when the shuttle drops you off. Jefferson Rock, okay? You know, Harper's Ferry is not all, you know, old buildings and that kind of thing. And it's also, you know, geologically a place to go check out. You know, you got the confluence of the rivers. You also have these rock formations. One is Jefferson Rock.
It's a national park. I mean,
yeah, right. 417 feet above the Shenandoah River. And this is the place in 1783 that Thomas Jefferson said of the view, quote, "This scene is worth a voyage across the Atlantic."
Okay, I got a dumb thing to comment here or ask. Why would anybody even write that down? What are you doing that you're an important person, but you stand up and you go, yeah, this scene is worth a voyage across the Atlantic. And somebody went, I'm writing that down.
Well, he wrote a collection of I can't remember the name of it, but it was a collection of letters, and it was in that, it was a journal. And he wrote that in that journal and published it, yeah, before he was president.
So this wasn't somebody dictating what he had said.
No,
this is his
own
personal
writing. Yeah.
Okay.
And so when I say that he said this, he wrote it.
Okay.
So many other famous people came here for the view as well, including abolitionist Frederick Douglass, General George Armstrong Custer, George Washington, Mark Twain, Alexander Graham Bell, and many presidents, including Woodrow Wilson.
Huh.
And it's on the trail, like I mentioned earlier, past St. Peter's Catholic Church and the St. John's ruins.
And even greater than all those men that he just mentioned was James himself has been there. So when you stand there, I want you to understand that you've stood where a world-renowned podcaster has stood.
Well, let me tell you this. I have one fear, heights. And my wife and I went years ago, and she is not afraid of heights in the least. And she was on the edge with 1 foot dangling over the edge, you know, 417 feet below her shoe. You know, just, and she's like, oh, I think I might be losing my balance. You're going to have to come get me. I said, you're on your own.
James is over there going to lose his cookies. She's losing her balance.
I wasn't going to come within 50 feet of the edge. So, yeah, I saw the rock, but I didn't see the view that it has to offer, which is a shame. But I just can't get over that fear of heights. I'm sorry.
That's what cameras are for. Get somebody to take a picture, and they can show it to you later.
Sorry about that.
You're okay.
So, of course, you know, it's such a big park. The lower town's like 400 acres, but the national park itself, 3,600 acres. So you're doing a lot of walking, which builds up that hunger. So there's plenty of sit-down places to eat and counter services. The sit-down restaurants, the Rabbit Hole, probably the most popular one there, and it's going up the hill out of town.
So what am I going to eat when I'm at the Rabbit Hole?
Just traditional sit-down fare, yeah.
Okay.
The Town's Inn, also a hot spot. Isabella's Pizza and Subs, Almost Heaven, Pub and Grill, the Coach House, Bar and Grill, and the Cannonball Deli. Not as popular as the Carnegie Deli, but definitely the most popular deli in Harpers Ferry, let's put it that way.
Yeah, like I said, the Rabbit Hole is the only one where I really didn't know what you'd be getting. I didn't know if they served wild game or...
Oh, no, no. Well, no.
Since it is the Rabbit Hole.
Right. But I tell you what the Rabbit Hole offers that most don't. They have a large deck that offers outdoor dining, and it overlooks the Harpers Ferry Amtrak station, which is in itself old, but built much later, you know, than the rest of the town. I think it was built in the 1890s.
Okay.
So, shopping, plenty of shopping to do there. As I mentioned earlier, the bookstore, of course, they sell books, but they also sell a lot of collectibles and, reproduction things like Confederate coins, or they have tokens with Jefferson Rock on it, or other things that are depicted in the town. If you're hot, you got drinks in there too.
That's important.
Yep. Check out the bookstore there. The Village Shop, just another place where you can pick up souvenirs and collectibles. Harpers Ferry General Store. Now, this is the place that you want to go to.
Oh, yeah? Why would I want to go there?
Well, like you said earlier, you'd like the dry goods place.
Okay.
There you go. Harpers Ferry General Store. Wide array of, items, and you're going to find some old stuff in there,
nice,
too. Yeah. How about Hodgepodge? It's a place for gifts, antiques, and collectibles.
I'm assuming there's just a smorgasbord of everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Hence, you're right. Hodgepodge.
Yep. Tessoterica, it's a gift shop as well, but they also offer bubble tea.
Now, what is bubble tea?
It's this new thing. It's like a fad.
Is this nitro-infused tea?
I don't know.
Like Pepsi?
I like that stuff, man. That is good stuff. But they have all these different flavors to it. I think they put a bunch of milk in it. I don't know. It's a trendy kind of thing.
Okay.
It's also, I don't know about at that place. I don't know how expensive it is, but we have a place.
Oh, so this is what's over in Merrill County. They have that place.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bubble tea. Yep. Also, you have the Tenfold Fair Trade Collection, which it's a store. It's very green conscious. Yeah. Then you have Tenfold Fair Trade Collection. Now, this is a store that offers all the collectibles that you get anywhere else, but they're high quality recycled or upcycled goods, and it's a really neat and unique place to go visit. Now, Vintage Lady, they offer collectibles and everything else too, but they offer so many West Virginia made items.
So break that down a little bit further for the listeners.
Well, one thing's salt. Now, I'm not sure exactly why they have West Virginia salt. I know there was a lot of salt mines in West Virginia in the past, so maybe that's why. But sodas and foods and that kind of thing. Okay. Maple syrup, you know, things that we make here. Hopefully.
Stuff they're only going to be able to get from here.
Right. Maybe pepperoni rolls are in there, too. I'm not sure. So that brings us to my favorite place to shop. And it's a place called True Treats Historic Candy. Now, this isn't a museum shop. This is a shop.
This is the real deal.
Yeah.
You're getting the old style candy, and you can go home with it.
Yes. So, so many things in there that are old fashioned. You know, they have tea mixes, and they have, you know, liniments and all this other weird stuff, you know, that you would see in the 1800s, right?
They got candy cigarettes.
Yes. They do.
Yes, I love those things.
And you know what? The friend I was with Wednesday, he said, I can't believe they have so many candy cigarettes here. I'm not kidding you. There's a little barrel full of them, you know, and then they have them in another shop, place, part of the shop. But old stuff that you can find in different places, but different packaging.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like the vintage packaging for like Hershey and maple nut goodies and stuff like that. But then stuff that you just never even heard of before, you know?
Right.
You've heard of Turkish taffy, right?
Yes.
Well, they also made something called Abba Zabba. It's like a banana taffy.
Abba Zabba.
And I've heard it on TV before, but I didn't even know it was a real thing.
You know? I've never even heard of it. Abba Zabba.
Yeah, it's a banana-flavored taffy. And then they have the orange or the fruit slices that are jellied.
Yes.
Yeah, I picked them up and got some of those, and they have old-fashioned gum like clove and blackjack and tea berry. Got a couple packs of tea berry gum, yes. And then they have a section that literally says 1800s, things that they sold in the 1800s. So I don't want to give away.
Did you try any of it? Did you pass?
I didn't pass because I didn't want to try it. It's just I'm a diabetic.
I'm tired.
I can't eat it.
I'm tired of excuses, James. Just because it can kill you doesn't mean you
got
to stop.
I can't eat it. I'm sorry, man. I got some things for my wife and kids, and I got tea berry gum, which, you know, you can have tea berry gum in an emergency. I don't know if you've ever chewed tea berry gum.
I have not.
Okay. What was Fruit Stripe famous for? Tasting great for 5 minutes and then tasting like nothing.
I don't even know if it tasted great for 5 minutes. I liked the packaging. That was about the only thing about
I love that Fruit Stripe. Tasted great. I didn't see any Fruit Stripe in this store, but they had tea berry and clove and blackjack. And of course, I think licorice is disgusting. Clove is disgusting. Tea berry is wonderful. Stuff. You know, fun fact, tea berry, it's not a berry. It's what they called wintergreen in the South. So that's the flavor.
Really?
Yeah. But I always liked it. My mom always had a big pack of it when I was young.
My favorite gum was always Big League Chew or Bubble Tape.
I liked Big League Chew.
I loved Big League Chew, man. And they had grape and strawberry.
Yeah,
and
grape was awesome. But I see it packaged, and when I'm at the store at the cash register, I'm like, no, I'm not getting it. I'm not getting it.
I always carried it with me when I played T-ball and Little League.
Yeah.
And it had it shoved in my back pocket.
Yep.
Because I wanted to look like John Kruk.
Yes,
with the jaw. Yes, with the jaw or the cheek sticking out 9 inches from the side of my face, just packed with Big League Chew.
Yep. I'm James.
And I'm Jerry.
You've been listening to West Virginia Talk, a J&J production.